please the court, Matthew Cicillo, Pomerantz LLP, representing lead plaintiff appellant Kazeem Akar, additional plaintiff appellants Landrum Emoji, and the putative class of investors. This appeal concerns a $1 billion securities fraud case by Tesla's aggrieved investors. The district court held that plaintiff's factual allegations, quote, had full evidentiary support, so no facts are disputed on the underlying evidence. Yes, Your Honor.
And what I want to know is what are the allegations that you propose to have added to the amended complaint had the dismissal been without prejudice that would save you from the dismissal that occurred?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor.
It may be excellent or it may not even be excellent, but it's one that's troubling me.
Sure.
So I'd like to know, what is the substantial denial of justice that has occurred here by virtue of the form of the dismissal?
In answer to your question, I'll know, and this is significant, we actually put forward those additional allegations on the record of the district court
in your Rule 59 motion.
Well, in our opposition to defendant's Rule 59 motion.
Right.
They moved to amend the judgment.
In your Rule 59 papers.
Correct. So we put in those allegations, and significantly the district court considered them in reaffirming its judgment. So it looked at those additional allegations, decided on the basis of that, everything else we said.
Where do I find those in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, I can get those to you. It's in our opposition papers on the Rule 59 motion. I'll answer your substantive question as I try to get the record cited. The list of additional allegations that we included are as follows. So supplemental confidential witness 15 was Tesla's shock vibration durability lead engineer. That's found at record excerpt 36, paragraph 44. That witness said that Tesla failed to do proper durability testing on the first 1,000 Model S cars produced, which was a safety hazard. That witness participated in mid-2012 meetings where the battery pack team manager disagreed with the decision to put the battery pack into production as then designed due to structural flaws. That confidential witness said that the engineers voiced, quote, strong opposition and, quote, were concerned about safety, but defendant Musk brushed it off and went into production. Supplemental witness 16, Tesla's associate manager of engineering, and that's at record excerpt 36, paragraph 45. That witness said, and this is also common sense, the battery pack is a structural component of a manufactured product that's heavily regulated and subject to government testing. That confidential witness said the battery pack would have been finalized at least 6 months before production because to redo it, you know, a month or two earlier would have started the clock all over. You would have had to resubmit it for government testing.
Counsel, I have a follow-up question to Judge Lucero's question, and that is this. As you said at the beginning of your response to him, the district court was aware of these additional potential allegations at the time it ruled that you would not be given another opportunity to amend the Second Amendment complaint. And the court nonetheless determined that even looking at that, there were either that the statements were either not false or misleading, or that to the extent that some of them might have been, they were not material. And having so ruled, then what's the point of going back and adding them in a formal way and having the court say the same thing again?
So, Your Honor,
why wouldn't we just consider that as part of our review?
I encourage you to. I think that on the de novo review now, the court is entitled to look at both everything that we allege, which frankly we think should have passed muster, that the court erred in dismissing the claim on the affirmative statements about the fires, about the refusal to disclose the Mexico fire that was coming, et cetera, the court can certainly turn an eye towards the entire record in making its determination now.
In other words, I think we have some case law that supports the thought that we can determine, using our de novo review, whether the complaint can be saved by the proposed amendment or not. And so, would you want us to exercise that opportunity?
We certainly cite precedent for example, when we've encouraged this court to address the scienter issue while we're here. There are ample cases in this jurisdiction that permit the court to have efficiencies, right, to not decide the falsity issue, send it back down. We had some ruling on scienter, either of us appeal, we're back here again in 2 years. So certainly there's precedent for doing that. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I can amend on appeal, which I'm sorry.
No, but in determining whether the district court abused its discretion in denying another opportunity to amend, part of our consideration is whether it would or would not have been futile.
Correct.
Okay, so in making that determination, if we were to disagree with it and determine that the proposed additional facts would not save the complaint, we have authority to do that, yes?
I think that's accurate. I think, as well, we are not limited to the ones that we put into.
Well, you're not limited, but remember,
you
amended the complaint twice. Once
with agreement.
Once with agreement, another time. So you had two amendments below, and you're saying to us, the judge abused his discretion by not letting us have another amendment. And the natural question is, well, what would you put in it? And if you said, I don't know, I think we'd say he didn't abuse his discretion.
Correct.
So what you said is we would add the things that are in the Rule 59 papers, and so...
That's all correct. And I would just clarify a little bit the procedural history. So when...
I understand that they were by agreement, and one was just changing a party. So I'm not...
And when Judge Breyer, issued his core ruling denying leave to amend, these facts had not been before him. He entered the order and the judgment. They moved, so I revised the judgment. And then at that point, we put it in.
Let me ask you about those facts then.
Correct.
Were they facts known to you before the time that you filed your response to the Rule 59 motion?
Certainly at the time that we filed the response, because they were in the papers.
No, I know.
Your question is, were they known at the point where he amended
a year earlier?
Yes.
No, are they known at the point when Judge Breyer issued his order dismissing the complaint with prejudice?
I don't recall the exact answer to that, because what happened...
Because I want to look at this from Judge Breyer's perspective.
Right.
You're saying, Judge, you should have... You come up to the Court of Appeals and say, Judge Breyer abused his discretion. He didn't allow us to amend. And we told him 6 months later, five months later, that we had a bunch of facts we would have put in the complaint had we been allowed to amend it. And he said to you, did you know those facts? Facts back when I was considering the motion to dismiss. And you said, yes. I don't think he would be within the abuse of discretion.
Now it's too late. My recollection is no, and the procedural history, which we'll recall it much more accurately and contemporaneously, is in our 59 e-papers, but I believe what we did was once we had the dismissal order, we continued our investigation, as we are always want to do, and we discovered additional confidential witnesses we can't contact until they leave the company. So as more former employees left, we continued our investigation, we continued our diligence, and that was important so that we could substantiate that the case was meritorious, et cetera, the issues that, initially the 59 motion. Our amendment history, though, if you look back at the case, this is a standard issue Exchange Act 10B case. There's an initial pleading, typically a little thinner, that is filed by some plaintiff. Here it was a non-lead plaintiff named Robert Rahimi. That was 32 pages long.
You then amended it to have a new
plaintiff. During the plaintiff process, a court-appointed lead plaintiff gets put into place. I think the amended complaint that comes after that, standard issue 10B, that is your operative maybe complaint. It follows an investigation with confidential witnesses, et cetera. That's the first pleading that the lead plaintiff puts forward.
How long after the operative complaint was the motion to dismiss filed?
I want to say the operative, so the first amendment complaint was filed in April 14.
Second.
No, the first amendment.
I'm asking about the second.
Yes, and then so what we did was on the day, and
June 16th, 2014.
Right.
Right. And that's the second amended complaint.
Correct. The motion to dismiss is filed the same day.
Okay. And how long after that does the judge resolve it?
The judge entered his, well, we had the oral argument on September 26th of 14, where there was a sort of a bench decree. The formal order entered in early December 14.
So we're talking about roughly a 6-month time period in which, had you discovered new information, you could have amended it.
Roughly speaking, though, my practice is typically not to try to amend as the motion is in this briefing is going on. This court's jurisprudence, you know, if anything, the eminence capital case, for example, says that when you, this is a hard area of the law. There's no discovery. There's heightened pleading burdens. And the acid test is the motion to dismiss. So we do the best we can.
And why I'm asking is you say we discover new facts, and that's why. To me, it's one thing to tinker with the complaint to deal with technical problems. But you're saying, oh, my gosh, we discovered as we got new facts or something important. I'm not, to me, it would be important to know when you found those out, because if you were holding them in reserve.
No. If we had had, you know, a smoking gun confidential witness, notwithstanding the fact that it wasn't in the amended complaint, I certainly would have offered it. At the motion is sincere. I don't think the judge would have considered it.
When approximately did you learn of the new confidential witness?
My recollection was that once we got the order, which was the substantive guidance as to what the district court perceived as the infirmities of our case, we then continue an investigation to try to target those weaknesses. We frankly did it in the context of the Sanghiati motion, but you know, it was also with an eye toward.
So it sounds like
you went on appeal.
It's an interesting answer, because it sounds like in that 6-month period until the court ruled, you were looking for more evidence.
No, that's not accurate. As a matter of my practice, whatever a case is pending.
I'm just trying to understand your responses to my colleague, because it sounded from your answer like you waited until you got the order identifying weaknesses, and then you decided to go look for more facts, rather than, we tried to find the people, but we couldn't. I mean, there's...
Well, our papers, and this is clear from the Rule 59 papers, Tesla actively impeded our investigation. And we brought this in front of Judge Breyer in opposing the Rule 59. Most of we contacted numerous confidential witnesses, which we detail in our 59 papers. And Tesla was contacting those witnesses and telling them not to speak with us and citing the NDA and threatening, vague legal action. So we were constantly trying to investigate the case throughout. We were thwarted at various points. But rest assured, my practice is to constantly investigate the cases I'm litigating if there's any sort of real-world development, even the day of the hearing, that would impact on the argument. I would have that prepared. The targeted search for confidential witnesses on specific issues was certainly guided and prompted by the judge's order on our motion to dismiss.
Did you want to say something about that?
I would like to, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Siegel.
This is the court, David Siegel, on behalf of the LA's Tesla and Elon Musk. And I'll accept, beginning at the end, the court's questions to counsel. At the Rule 59, on the Rule 59 motion, Judge Breyer not only said that there was evidentiary support sufficient to avoid sanctions, but he added that even with the allegations made, it did not come close. None of the allegations came close to being actionable or converting any of the statements that were challenged.
So do we review that? Do we review that conclusion to no vote to see whether or not he should have allowed leave to amend?
Well, I think that the standard on leave to amend is for abuse of discretion. Did the court abuse his discretion in not permitting leave to amend? But I do believe that this court has the power to review for futility new allegations.
Let's assume something.
New allegations.
Let's assume something that you won't concede because you shouldn't. let's assume we look at those new allegations and say, oh, my gosh, they really do state a claim. What do we do?
I think if the court were to look at the allegations and determine that there was a lack of futility and no waiver, which are two huge hurdles, then the court has the power to reverse and remain, obviously.
If they're new information, how could there be waiver?
Well, because these allegations were put at a minimum in the opposition to the Rule 59 motion. And I'll get to other stages in the process that lead to waiver. But there was no request at that point to amend the judgment and grant leave. Remember, the motion, Rule 59, is brought to modify a judgment.
It was your motion. You were seeking sanctions.
Correct. Correct. And in opposing that, if plaintiffs had, as counsel just said, they continue their investigation, and if they find new allegations of what they perceive to be a smoking gun, they raise it, and they ask for leave. They didn't do that. They didn't present to the judge a request, hey, would you please modify your judgment?
They just said, you shouldn't sanction us because we even have more information.
Correct. Okay. That was their argument. They even said at excerpt, to the record, page 30, paragraph 40 of their opposition, some of these allegations. We have other allegations, and we've chosen not to include them in the complaint. It gets a little confused later on which are the ones they had chosen not to continue because of some questions they had about credibility.
But that would be perfectly appropriate when imposing sanctions.
Correct. And it's quite a different standard than the standard on whether or not there was a sufficient allegation falsity here to allege a securities fraud.
We never addressed the actual meat of the appeal with your opponent, but there's at least a couple statements the individual defendant makes about, we've only had one fire out of every 8,000, I think it was.
And it's about 25,000 cars at that point.
But whatever number.
100 million bucks.
Let's assume that the real number was double banked for a moment. Or unless there had been one in a prototype and it should have been counted. Is that statement then material innocent?
Well, no, not in that context, and it's not false. Because a prototype fire would not be subject to
this. Okay, let's assume for a second that it is, just for purposes. I'm trying to figure out whether or not the numbers make the statement material misleading if they're divided in half.
Correct. Okay.
On that point, wasn't there a fire on the shelf?
There were at least two, and the plaintiffs alleged three pre-class fires. The first was a prototype, a battery not even installed in a car that somehow combusted. Tells us nothing. The second fire is the one on which they focus, which is the third, which is on a storage cart that may be the one to which Your Honor is referring, where all that we know from the record is something burned. There's no evidence or allegation as to what caused that fire, when it started, how it started, or actually whether even a battery was involved. The middle fire is the one that they staked really their case on. That's the fire where, in a test of what would happen if there were a fire in a crash, Tesla started the fire. We started the fire.
To find out what happened when a fire started.
Correct. That's what one does when you're trying to design a safe automobile.
If that's what I call on the shelf, it's on the car.
Correct. If that's out, and it is out, it tells us nothing.
Just that.
The middle one, the December 2011, the one we started, where they said, well, it was called a fire crash test, therefore it's relevant to the accuracy of this statement that they're in. At the time that Tesla first said there had been no fires observed in a crash test from a crash, much less, and this is the core of the case, they're alleging that there was a known risk of a high vulnerability to fires being caused from collisions with the undercarriage of the car. That's their whole case. Well, there isn't a single example anywhere in the record of that occurring before the Washington fire, period. Mexico's quite different. The Mexico fire, we have someone very late at night driving at over 100 miles an hour, I think one report said 110 miles an hour, all of this is in the record. Goes on.
Designed to go that fast.
Oh, it's designed to go a bit faster if one wants.
Was it being driven outside its design parameters?
No, but on the narrow streets of Merida, probably not driven safely at that moment. It goes through a concrete barrier and into a tree. He walks away, and he watches as it catches on fire. Now, no one has ever said quite the opposite. No one has ever said that if you have a violent crash with this car, just like any other car loaded with gasoline, that these high-energy lithium-ion batteries that burn energy and create heat won't catch on fire or cannot catch on fire.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying ultimately is that even if the number should have been 2 instead of 1, to use Judge Hurwitz's example, because of the nature of what happened, it wasn't misleading.
It wasn't misleading for a number of reasons. The comment to which the court refers was made in direct response to the reported incident. Tell us what you know about the Washington fire. Because that was an unusual fire. That was just driven under normal highway collisions, colliding with road debris, and we had a fire. So what happened? Is this going to raise concerns that this new technology is actually not as safe as advertised? Is there going to be a problem? Will there be a recall? You know, should we as investors become concerned that this problem might force redesign? All risks that Tesla had conspicuously and repeatedly disclosed in all of its public securities filings. If there is a fire, these risks could be realized.
I guess I'm asking a different question. I'm not sure it's possible. I'm just trying to understand what your position is. Let's say there's a statement here.
Yes.
There's one fire for every 1,300 gasoline cars. In our case, there's one fire for every 8,000 cars. So our case is 5 times less likely to have a fire. Our car is 5 times less likely to have a fire than a gasoline car.
Correct.
The one fire, of course, that's being counted is Washington.
At that point, yes.
Let's assume we had another one to this.
Yes.
Let's assume there are 2 fires for every 8,000 cars. Does that make this statement material misleading?
No. And first, the math changes.
Well, and also, Mr. Musk is a very smart person, but he can't multiply. It's one for every 1,400, and there's one, the other one's one for every 8,000, it makes it 1 in 5. I think it makes it 1 in 6.
Correct. Which the math also changes as we add more cars. Mr. Musk, and what the law requires is if you're going to engage in any kind of a statistical analysis, it doesn't have to be the best statistical analysis, it may not even have to be the right math, but you have to tell people, here's what I've done, here's how I got to it, and I think it was his October 4 blog that the court may be referencing where he goes through.
Oh, it's the interview on 11.
Oh, okay, that's later.
Yes.
That's later. Good enough. And indeed, you know, we're not arguing materiality on a motion, on this motion to dismiss. We're saying, is that a sufficient enough error?
Thank you, because that was really my question.
Error.
We're arguing lack of materiality.
To lead to false, you know, and it's not. Because it does not.
Spontaneous fire, or they're sitting in a tarmac in the case. Or I don't know if you're making a case of what's called the situation. That certainly warranted pulling all those airplanes, just grounding every one of them until the mission was resolved and over and over again.
Correct.
You've got a fire starting at every one out of every 8,000 cars, and you happen to be the guy who got the 8,000th car. It's pretty material.
Correct, but the fires didn't just combust, and that's the difference. It wasn't just the battery.
It was just about the one on the shelf. What I call on the shelf.
The other question, though, is what is material to a potential passenger getting on an airplane, and what is material to an investor? Maybe two different things.
Quite different.
Because an investor may be willing to put up with risk that a passenger is not, and vice versa.
An investor in an innovative product, the first of its kind, has to be willing to at least stomach a little bit of risk in a car. Any car, I submit to the court, any car that given the right circumstances in a collision, there may be a fire. There may be lots of things that happen to that car in a collision that creates risk. And investors, a company discloses that risk, as Tesla did, conspicuously, and does its best to ameliorate the risk. Now, they challenge and quarrel with some of the decisions made with respect to engineering. Now, I'm going to get back to the court's opening lines about what are these new witnesses, what might they add, because the question is answered nothing. They add nothing. And in one of the ways they don't add anything is it's just more evidence if you take it at face value. It's not pled. It's just in their in their response on the opposition to the Rule 59 motion.
Telling us that there is a find a motion.
Well, there was an earlier motion, but not after the judgment, not after the motion to dismiss. And indeed, Your Honors, first, the second amended complaint did not just change the name on the caption. It added some substantive allegations. Indeed, it added one that they highlighted in opposition to the motion to dismiss, discussing how somehow a fourth quarter fire and event made third quarter financial statements actionable, and that was not carried forward. Then, in response to the motion to dismiss itself, they submitted additional factual arguments and purported evidence that they wanted the court to conclude, considered, and the court did. That had no validity either. It was a fire in, I think, the Toronto garage. And the one thing you could tell from the photo that they supplied is the one area that didn't burn was where the battery pack was. And so that went nowhere. And at the hearing, the court said, this is it. Make your best argument. Tell me anything you've got. And he had expressed some skepticism with what they had. So what they have now are a confidential witness, 16, who speculates that, well, the battery would not have been changed after six months left. And it's just they would not have been changing it. With only 6 months to go to production. That's just speculation. And CW15, who's talks about, well, I thought that they needed to make other changes, that it wasn't yet safe enough. That's the kind of engineering debate that tells us nothing about securities fraud. And that's what Judge Breyer found very strongly when he said, don't come in and just second guess engineering decisions and say they could have made it safer. Fraud by hindsight, not permitted in this or any circuit. And as the Allison and Roncone Court know, anytime you're innovating, you're going to make trade-offs and decisions. And so that doesn't take them anywhere either. And indeed, ours engineering decisions, which as the record reflects, included adding a quarter inch of armor paneling under the car's undercarriage. Putting in firewalls internally instead of protective sleeves around 11,000 cells led us to believe, as the Second Amendment complaint acknowledged in paragraph 101, that we had designed the same car. And the NHTSA testing validated that. And after the first fire, we made an optional and voluntary upgrade of technology to allow the driver to raise the car. That's after the third fire, I'm sorry, in Tennessee. And that is not the stuff of securities.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to focus on the merits appeal for a moment. Judge Cicero, you were asking about the three class period fires, and I think the December 19th, 2011 fire warrants a bit of discussion. The uncontested fire department report states that was a, quote, crash fire test, and a confidential witness, one, says that was induced at the center of the battery pack. So what was Tesla doing? Tesla was basically testing the exact events that occur in Washington and Tennessee fires later in the class period. They were trying to figure out, crash with road debris in the center of the battery pack, what happens?
Isn't that a whole different animal? I mean, if the question is how often does this car crash into a tree, and the designer responses. It's my purpose to have a crash into a tree to see what follows from that. I don't see how you can count that as an incident of you crashed into a tree. It's part of the testing and design process. It's not, I guess I just have
one question. The Model S and the MRM battery did not catch time. It did not catch fire at any time before any HTSA testing.
Look, setting it on fire on purpose to see what happens is not the same as catching fire.
They induced a puncture of the battery pack in the center. They expected perhaps, you know, one battery might smoke a bit. What happened was a thermal runaway event that destroyed the car in minutes. It required 23 first responders from 9 units on the scene. Tesla concealed those facts from its employees and concealed them from the first responders.
Here's my difficulty. Everybody, even Mr. Musk, says the car occasionally catches on fire because of the battery. He says 1 in 8,000. Maybe it's fewer. They've demonstrated that in their pre-production stuff. There is a danger of it catching on fire. The question is, what is the level of the danger, correct? I'm not sure how you can
Some
out the test that demonstrates that the danger exists.
So they're
showing the level of the danger.
They've made these decisions compromising safety, as we describe them, that lowers the car at highway speed. They removed patented undercarriage shielding on the bill. They removed individual...
But you're not making a car safety argument. You're making a misrepresentation argument.
Correct.
And we all agree that what was out in public was that there was a car fire at the time of this. That's the time of the class allegations. There was one in Washington.
That was the first one that occurred.
We know that the investor class knows that it's possible for the car to catch on fire.
To some degree, but they described it as...
They say it doesn't occur very often. It occurs 1 every 8,000 times. And I'm not sure why it is that it's relevant to that. That during testing, they actually demonstrated that it could catch on fire.
They described that event as unusual, as peculiar. Even after the third fire, they said there's no need for a recall. They basically talked
about it. There wasn't a recall.
Well,
there, in fact, was not a recall.
The statement that there's no need for a recall conveys that there's nothing wrong with the vehicle. The fact that a week later, they issued, my car is not as hip as a Model S. If my car needed to be raised, I'd have to take it to the dealership. A mechanic would lift it up, etc. The Model S allows that adjustment to be done over the air. They raised every Model S a week after.
That's not a recall.
That is, as we allege, those are steps cannot recall. And if you look at this court's decision in Hannon, for example, where there were optimistic statements about a product and a senior vice president's diary entries from prior to that were deemed to be sufficient to make those misstatements actionable. Or in the Supreme Court's Matrix decision, where there were statements about safety, and we have non-statistically significant adverse event reports in the background, and that was deemed to make those statements misleading. Here we have conscious decisions that make the very circumstances of the Washington and Tennessee fires more likely. We have defendants knowing that if that battery pack gets punctured, that car is going to be destroyed in 2 minutes. Investors had no idea that was a material risk of this product. And it's the only product that Tesla makes.
Yeah. One question, and I think you can answer yes or no.
Sure.
I suspect you won't, but I just think you put these facts in your response to the Rule 59 motion to amend when the other side was seeking sanctions. Was your opponent correct in saying that at that time you did not seek leave of the court to have the judgment vacated so you could amend your complaint?
We had a standing request to amend.
No,
what we said in the Rule 59 paper is that I can remember that.
In
an amended complaint, listed what they were. After hearing that, the judge then.
No, you respond. I'm asked a very specific question. You responded to the Rule 59 motion with a response with some facts in it. Did you say to the judge, we would like you, judge, to vacate the judgment so we may file a third amended complaint to allege these facts?
All we said was that we would include these in a further amended complaint.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. The case just started to be submitted, and we appreciate both counsel's very interesting arguments.